Next week we're studying the chapter on the child in Ministry of Healing, the one following our chapter tonight on the mother. This chapter is really not only on the mother, for it has quite a bit to say about the father. But the mother is the one who is emphasized the most in this chapter, and the father is emphasized primarily as he can help the mother. That's the main emphasis found in it. We've entitled this topic tonight, The Greatest of the Arts. And you say, where did you ever find a title like that for mother? And it's found on page 378 of this chapter, the last page of the chapter, 378 of Ministry of Healing. And it's a very, very important quotation, an interesting one found there at the top of the page. No other work can equal hers in importance. And then she makes some comparisons. She has not, like the artist, to paint a form of beauty upon canvas, nor, like the sculptor, to chisel it from marble. She has not, like the author, to embody a noble thought in words of power, nor, like the musician, to express a beautiful sentiment and melody. She has not any of those. It is hers, with the help of God, to develop in a human soul the likeness of the divine. When Jesus comes, we're going to have a startling awakening. And all that man has counted important is going to be turned upside down. Totally. And the things we've counted of almost no value are suddenly going to be the greatest things in the world. And I mean Seventh-day Adventists. We think in reverse most of the time, so far as our value systems are concerned. If a woman is a great artist and a Seventh-day Adventist, she would be someone of great prestige. If she was a world-renowned organist or vocalist, we would all applaud her and say, my, aren't you proud she's a Seventh-day Adventist. If she's a great mother, we all turn up our noses. Who cares? Isn't that right? No prestige at all. That means you think more of canvas, more of stone, more of books, and more of melodies than you do of a human being. Isn't that right? That means you'd rather see a great work of art on stone or canvas than you would to see a great work of art in a human being. That means you'd rather see some great author writing something in a book or some great music, a score on some music sheets, than you would to see someone do a magnificent job with a human being. And we call that correct thinking. And we get our PhD in that and are proud because we know so much. And how foolish we are. Isn't that right? How foolish we really are. I don't suppose there's hardly an exception here. We think someone, a woman who'd do all these other things would be a great asset to God's cause. But someone who raises a child and reproduces the divine image on that child, so what? Isn't that right? So what? Nobody gets excited. And that person is not great. But God says it is hers, with the help of God, to develop in a human soul the likeness of the divine. No artist will ever do that. No musician, no writer, no sculptor. They'll never do that. When they get through, all they've created is a good likeness of some person or some scene, right? Or something. But when you have recreated a human being through cooperating with God, they're in the likeness of God. And you're the artist who created that human being that can talk, think, love, respond, react, worship, obey, serve. Is that right? All these marvelous things that a human can do that no statue or painting or music or writing can ever do. And yet we call the others great. We don't call this very great. Now, I wanted you to understand this. She put it at the end of the chapter. I wanted to put it at the beginning because I think we have so degenerated in these modern times that we don't recognize, why should we study a chapter about motherhood? I don't think it's important anymore, you know. Everything else is important. Why don't you tell us something exciting? Reproducing the image of God in man is the most exciting thing there is, right? Nothing so wonderful, nothing so great. How many mothers here have never understood your work? Just to this one little paragraph, you know. Did you ever know that you're an artist, of the greatest artist, you know? Reproducing a soul in the likeness of God. Better than the painter, or the sculptor, or the author, or the musician. Better than all of us put together as the mother. Carving out, by God's divine grace, a beautiful soul to whom the Lord will say, well done and good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord because of what you've done to that soul. Right? It's so different than what we think. The mother who appreciates this will regard her opportunities as priceless. She gives these comparisons. So the mother who knows this, you know, regards her opportunities as priceless. There's no one like a mother, is what she's really saying. Earnestly will she seek, in her own character and by her methods of training, to present before her children the highest ideal. Earnestly, patiently, courageously, she'll endeavor to improve her own abilities, that she may use aright the highest powers of the mind in the training of her children. Earnestly will she inquire at every step, what hath God spoken? Diligently she will study his word. She'll keep her eyes fixed upon Christ, that her own daily experience in the lowly round of care and duty may be a true reflection of the one true life. Her own life be the true reflection of the one true life. I've known about pianists who practice 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, some seven, in order to be a good musician. There are some artists who spend a whole lifetime just to become a better artist. There are some writers who do the same thing. But when you finish reading Advent at Home, you're discouraged and want to quit. Is that right? These other people think that the goal to achieve in those other arts is sufficiently important to work and work and work for 50, 60 years. But for us to have a little study about child rearing, you know, we quickly exhaust our energies because the goal is not important, right? Children will grow up without training, and they'll be untrained children. But they'll grow up, won't they? But what will they be like? And what a difference it could be if we would take the time that other artists take to perfect their arts. If we took the same time to perfect the art of motherhood and fatherhood, how different life would be. Somehow we have to go back and change our value system until we rate motherhood where it belongs, because you're working with human beings. The nicest work ever committed to man. Is that what she calls working with children? The nicest, the most delicate, the finest, the greatest art. Working with human minds in these tender bodies and souls of little children, so responsive, so reflective, so reactive, so quick, aren't they, to learn and to do the things. Just unbelievable reactions we find these little children. And we don't understand with what we work, or we surely would not take it so casually as we have in the past. And we'd regard any profession as being inferior. And every profession is inferior to motherhood. Every profession. You're taking a thousand steps down to work in other areas, at least. You're going down to some of the lowest categories to work with things when you leave people. Right? And even medicine, sometimes, the way we have it nowadays, is not working with souls, but with bodies. Which is more important, with souls or bodies? And when they're your own, you know, is that more important to you? Does your own heart react with more love for those of your own? Doesn't it? Wouldn't that be more delightful and more rewarding? Then our value system must be straightened out, or a chapter like this is almost meaningless. I wonder how many people in Loma Linda read this chapter in the last 50 years. How few people. I honestly do. And I think the reason why is we just don't think it's very important, you know? But we would study and study and study by the hundreds of hours to get a degree in one of the other arts or another profession, bypassing this one entirely because it just doesn't rate. It doesn't have the importance. Now, when we as Christian people are concerned about God's value system more than we are about man's rating of prestige, where will we find ourselves? What will we be seeking? You see, we have been literally brainwashed by traditional thinking by human beings as to what is important nowadays. And we've turned everything upside down, and the devil's totally deceived us and taught us to believe these other things have more prestige. They do in the minds of men and women, but not in the minds of God. And not in the minds of the children who are the objects of that training or the lack of it. Not in their minds at all. And we lament and lament that our children have so many problems these days. If we went back and put motherhood and fatherhood at the top of the heap, they wouldn't be like they are. And they wouldn't be staying away from church and Sabbath school. Not at all. They'd be delighted to come. But we must rate it important enough to be with them and to train them. The most important. or they'll be just like we are, and now I'm back to the beginning of the chapter, page 371, for that's what it starts out with. It starts out with a text, actually, there. All that I command her, let her observe. And that's taken from Judges 13, verse 14, where it talks about the mother of Samson. We're coming to that after a while. And as it goes on there, remember now we're still talking about the home being therapeutic for society. It's in a chapter on healing. It's in a book on ministry of healing, the home. And mothers and fathers are supposed to be the physicians of society as they train their children. They cause the uplifting of society, as we studied for the last two or three weeks. So keep in that context as we go along here. And notice the importance there in the very first two paragraphs on page 371. What the parents are, that to a great extent the children will be. However you estimate this, that's what children are going to be, you see. The physical conditions of the parents, their dispositions and appetites, their mental and moral tendencies are to a greater or less degree reproduced in their children. The physical, she mentions, isn't that right? Their dispositions and appetites, mental and moral tendencies, to a greater or less degree reproduced in their children. The nobler aims, the higher the mental and spiritual endowments, and the better developed the physical powers of the parents, the better will be the life equipment they give their children. In cultivating that which is best in themselves, parents are exerting an influence to mold society and to uplift future generations. Just think, as we as parents cultivate that which is best in ourselves, we're exerting influence on all society, molding them and uplifting future generations. The better you do with yourself in caring for the physical, the mental, and the spiritual, the better society will be in the future because of that. Not only do you benefit, but your children and the influence on society that the home has, which we studied two or three weeks ago. And so when we understand the importance of our work and what we're really doing, we're either causing society to degenerate or to become more healthy. Every one of us. Because we have some kind of influence on society and on our own homes and on others. And so this is the reason why parenthood is so very, very important. And all of you could go back and reflect on your parents, and you would show to anyone observing you that you're just showing that what your parents are is what you are, generally speaking. Unless the Lord brings about some radical change in you, you'd be very much like your parents. And even then, many habits and tendencies remain from the parents, right? Many, many of them. And we walk like our parents, one of them. We speak like them. We have their habits, good and bad, of all kinds, don't we? Many, many things. Often we look like them. And often we look like them mentally and spiritually as well as physically. The strength of heredity is great. And she goes to great lengths to show us just how much is involved in this. Now, if we're not inspired as to the enormity and the importance of the task of parents, we'll neglect our work. If your work is not important, why care? Why be careful about it, you see? Why take pains? Why study about it? It's not important. And life is filled with accidents and tragedies caused by people who thought their work was not important. And when you're the object of that lack or neglect, you quickly find out. I've kept a list of things, mainly for children's stories through the years, of people who thought their jobs were not important. In Washington State, quite a few years ago, one of the old-fashioned prop airplanes took off, a passenger airliner, I believe from Seattle, and climbing out. And as it got up a few hundred feet in the air, it just veered off to the side and crashed in the mountains, and every person on board was killed. Something like 40 or 50 people. It didn't take them very long to find out what was wrong. They went out into the charred wreckage of the burned airplane, and there they found a red piece of wood burned around the edges, about that thick and about a foot long, with a singed rope on the end of it. And they carried it back to the inspectors and told them where they found it in the wreckage, and that was all they needed to know. The fellow went around and pulled the chocks from the airplane, you know, the little nobody, the grease monkey they call him. He also had to take off the control locks that they used to use in those days that locked the ailerons and the elevators and the rudder so the wind wouldn't flop them around. And he left the one on one aileron. And there it was, and the fellow stalled out and rolled in. He lost some control of the airplane, probably didn't realize it was gone. It was still there. And it was still in the airplane when it crashed. And that fellow didn't think his job was important.
And I suppose he thought, that stupid pilot, you know, he can't fly. But it wasn't the pilot. It was the fellow who thought his job wasn't important because he wasn't flying. I and a friend were the object of somebody's neglect one time. The fellow who filled our airplane with gasoline when we were flying from India to China during the war. He was sure his job wasn't important. He just pumped gasoline in airplanes by the thousands of gallons all day long. That's a terrible job, boring as can be. But the fellow that's flying out there high in the sky is very dependent on that fellow to do it right. If he doesn't do it right, his neglect shows up in what happens to you. And on those airplanes, they have gas caps that twist in and lock because of much vibration on those wings, and the gas caps can come loose. And so they lock them in place and put a handle down so it can't jar loose. They have a couple little holes between the handle and the top of the cap, and they put safety wire through there so it cannot possibly come loose. But he was in a hurry, and his job wasn't important, so he didn't do that. In fact, I wonder if he even turned the handle on the gas cap. So we left the ground, climbing up over the mountains, and there the mountains followed you up in the air, climbing up the side of them. Left the ground, I looked out, and it looked like smoke coming out of the top of our engine. But it was aviation gasoline shooting out like a fire hose, right into the exhaust, hundreds of gallons. I wish you could have sat there and watched it and waited for yourself to go into nothing, you know. I finally cut back the throttle, but you couldn't because you need all the power fully loaded. And to stop siphoning the gasoline out of the top of the tank, we zipped around and landed fully loaded, which was also dangerous. And I don't know how many hundred gallons we sprayed over that little village, but someone lit a match with nothing left of it, just pouring raw gasoline all over it. But that fellow didn't care what he was doing. It wasn't important. I could keep your hours telling about people who don't think their job is important. And our kids are the evidence that we don't think that job is important. And the jails and the courts and hundreds of other places, the reformatories are filled with people because someone else thought it wasn't important. And somehow God in this chapter is trying to say, do you realize what you're doing? The opportunities you have, the endless accomplishments that can be made by training children. Unlimited achievement, isn't that right? The capacity to grow and to learn, to be cultivated of children is just amazing. And you're amazed sometimes at the little boy next door or girl next door comes back 20 years later, you know, a very accomplished person. And you wonder where they came from. Somebody took the pains, isn't that right? To work with them hundreds of hours. That made them different. It shows up in their society. It shows up in you and me as well. So we must be inspired about our work. And then the Lord will accomplish with us what he wants to do because we want to cooperate as we should. Now, the preparation of the child for the future, not only after conception, but prior to that time, prior to birth, rather, and after it's born, is discussed here later on in that chapter on page 371. Fathers and mothers need to understand their responsibility. The world is full of snares for the feet of the young. Multitudes are attracted by a life of selfish and sensual pleasure. They cannot discern the hidden dangers of the fearful ending of the path that seems to them the way of happiness. They don't see very far down the road, you see. Through the indulgence of appetite and passion, their energies are wasted, and millions are ruined for this world and for the world to come. Parents should remember that their children must encounter these temptations. Now, you don't remember them after encountering them. Remember them far in advance. Even before the birth of the child, the preparation should begin that will enable it to fight successfully the battle against evil. So now before it's born, we begin preparing the child for that battle. They'll probably not come until it's a teenager, you see, before it's very significant. So all during his early childhood, remember she says it's characters all formed by the time of 7 or 8, and we're always trying to change them when they're 16, and they scream and kick and holler because they're not ready to be changed then, you see. And if you wait until they're 19 or 20 or 21, they probably become very violent with you. And by the way, they're smarter than we are. Isn't that right? We didn't have sense enough to perceive in the training period, the preparing period, what was going to happen. When we suddenly begin to see our product, we get alarmed and say, I don't want that, you know. Who's going to brand that tag on me of training that child? And then we are desperate trying to change our image by changing theirs, right? And we fight and argue and hassle and nag and quibble and quarrel, you know, all the things we do. And they kick and holler and scream and tell us, you know, how bad we are. Because they're unchangeable then. Literally. They're unchangeable. And when people come to ask me, what can I do if my child is 16? And I said, you know, it's too late. Pray. That's all you can do. Most of us talk too much then, don't we? That isn't going to help. Most of us become very strict then. But we're very lenient when they're 6 or 4. That won't help, will it? The time is early, even before they're born. Prepare them for life's battles, she said. And she goes on and elaborates how we must accomplish some of this on page 372, the top of the page. And she gives some biblical examples here about this training. Especially does responsibility rest upon the mother. Why? She by whose life blood the child is nourished and its physical frame built up, imparts to it also mental, spiritual influences that tend to the shaping of mind and character. So now she has an influence by her very physical blood going through that child, you see. But in addition, she also imparts to it mental and spiritual influences. So while she's carrying that child, all these influences are taking place. And then the Bible is quoted. It was Jochebed, the Hebrew mother, who strong in faith, now it tells her character, you see, was not afraid of the king's commandment, quoting from Hebrews 11:23, of whom was born Moses, deliverer of Israel. Why was he so bold? His mother was like that, right? She was the bold one. Moses took after her. He wasn't afraid to come down and tackle Pharaoh after he had a mother like Jochebed, you see, who violated the king's commandment to take and hide her child. So he grew up a mother like that. She imparted her character to him. It was Hannah, the woman of prayer and self-sacrifice and heavenly inspiration. Notice the descriptions given now. What was the description of Jochebed? Strong in faith and not afraid of the king's commandment. That was her character. Hannah, a woman of prayer, self-sacrifice, heavenly inspiration. That's her character. Who gave birth to Samuel, the heaven-instructed child, the incorruptible judge, the founder of Israel's sacred schools. Just like his mother. Right? Extremely dedicated person. It goes on to Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, the kinswoman and kindred spirit of Mary. Had a spirit like Mary, the mother of Jesus, who was the mother of the Savior's herald. Why was John like he was? Because Elizabeth was like she was. The mothers passed on their very character to their children as well as their physical likeness. And now she goes on next, and she covers three areas in which the mother should exercise caution. Now, most of these we never think about. The first one's quite obvious, but the next two are less obvious. And so I'll spend a little time on all three of these. What areas must the mother watch to have the right influence on her children? Where should she exercise these precautions? The first one's called temperance and self-control. And this covers more territory than many of us realize. And it begins right there in the middle of the page. The carefulness with which the mother should guard her habits of life is taught in the Scriptures. When the Lord would raise up Samson as a deliverer for Israel, the angel of Jehovah appeared to the mother with special instruction concerning her habits and also for the treatment of her child. Beware, he said, and now drink no wine or strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing. And that's taken from Judges 13, verses 7 and 13. The effect of prenatal influences is by many parents looked upon as a matter of little moment, but heaven does not so regard it. You think that way, but heaven doesn't, what she's saying. The message sent by an angel of God and twice given in the most solemn manner shows it to be deserving of our most careful thought. Verse 7 and verse 14 is repeated. And so if the angel repeated it, he's trying to drive it home so she'd never forget it, right? So heaven thinks that's important. In the words spoken to the Hebrew mother, God speaks to all mothers in every age. Let her beware, the angel said. All that I command her, let her observe. And Ellen White has used that as the heading of this chapter, the first scripture mentioned. The well-being of the child will be affected by the habits of the mother. Her appetites and passions are to be controlled by principle. There is something for her to shun, something for her to work against, if she fulfills God's purpose for her in giving her a child. If before the birth of her child she is self-indulgent, if she is selfish, impatient, and exacting, these traits will be reflected in the disposition of the child. Now, if before that child is born, right? Before the birth of the child, she's self-indulgent, selfish, impatient, exacting, these traits will be reflected in the disposition of the child. Thus, many children have received as a birthright almost unconquerable tendencies to evil. And when the child manifests those at 13 or 14, we blame the child. And it takes us a long time to discover how much we had to do with this. One evening, a member of one of my churches many years ago in another city called me, about 8 o'clock, I think, weeping. And she said, "I wish you'd come by my house. I need help." So I drove her home, and there she had a little baby and another child, her grandchildren. The other child was asleep. The baby was in her arms, and the grandmother was sobbing. And she began to tell me the sordid story about her daughter, probably 23 at that time, I would think, and the mother probably around 50, something like that. And she said, "You know, my daughter was married to a man, the father of the child is asleep, and told me how long and the troubles they had, and she left him. He left her. They broke up. She came home to live with her mother. Mother helped babysit the baby while the daughter went out to make a living. And then she married another fellow." And they weren't married all the time, part of the time, but they were living together, and she had another child, the baby. And she said 3 months ago or so, she broke up with him, and she began to tell me the succession of the fellows she'd been sleeping with since that time. And she said, "I didn't bring you here to tell you about my daughter." She said, "What really hurts is that's what I did when I was her age." What would you say? That's when pastors earn their pay. You can't pay me enough to make visits like that. Because I go home and I can't sleep. You can't correct it. You can't do anything. And say pray sounds very empty under those circumstances. Because she's prayed and prayed and prayed for years. But the daughter's like the mother. Ellen White would like us to be saved from that grief. Some people think she's critical, you know, writing a chapter about mothers, and some people feel very, very criticized by her. But that woman would have given $1 million to follow this chapter. Gladly. Much more than that if she could find it. Anything to be saved from that grief of having the child throw on her face the mother's own life, night after night as Granny sat home babysitting and knew what her daughter was doing. It was just pure torture. Lived her sins over and over again thousands of times in her daughter's life. When she was that age, she defended her actions as her daughter now did. And now she grieved over them. And she grieved more of her own than she did her daughter's. And she had a hard time finding any fault. I'll tell you, this chapter is priceless. It really is. And some of us have to learn as severe a way as she has learned. We must. We'll never learn another way. And the Lord in His kindness will allow us to suffer that grief, that we might understand what our sins were really like in our neglect of our own children. We'll never understand the other way. If the picture's not painted in gory details, somehow it'll never penetrate these impervious heads of ours. Never will. It must become severe before we see. Isn't that right? It's so difficult to see otherwise. And all of us have problems this way. We can't point at somebody else. The Lord has given us counsel that we might have peace. And how precious is that word, isn't it? That we might have peace. May God help us who can still do something to heed some of the marvelous counsel given here before it's too late. She goes on a positive side on page 373, lest we end in a negative tone. But if the mother unswervingly adheres to right principles, if she is temperate and self-denying, if she is kind, gentle, and unselfish, she may give her child these same precious traits of character. They'll just be passed on as surely as the negative ones. And your good character will be reflected in that child as surely as the others, just as much. And you'll feel so proud because the child copied you and the child received of you. And so whatever we do with our lives, we reproduce it in the lives of others. And yet we think that we're all by ourselves in this world and have almost no influence. And we think a mother's job is a very slight one, you know, not too important. And how much difficulty it causes us as we go through life. The next section she discusses is one you'd almost never think about, and she's talking about mothers, and it's called overwork. And I don't know what she would write today if she lived in our century, in our decade, in this speedy age. I don't know what she would write. For this is certainly a minimization of our age, is it not? To just call it overwork is almost not saying enough. She said the strength of the mother should be tenderly cherished. And she has real reasons. She's talking about the therapy, the healing virtue in the home and in parents. The strength of the mother should be tenderly cherished. Instead of spending her precious strength in exhausting labor, her care and burden should be lessened. Often the husband and the father is unacquainted with the physical laws which the well-being of his family requires him to understand. In other words, fellas, we're kind of ignoramuses, kind of crude old cavemen without good thinking, you see, none perceptive. It says, absorbed in the struggle for a livelihood or bent on acquiring wealth and pressed with cares and perplexities, he allows to rest upon the wife and mother burdens that overtax her strength at the most critical period and cause feebleness and disease. And he might turn around and say, how come God's so tough on my family? Because the father of that family was very severe. He thought his other things were more important. He neglected. It goes on the top of page 374. Many a husband and father might learn a helpful lesson from the carefulness of the faithful shepherd, Jacob, when urged to undertake a rapid and difficult journey, made answer, and his quote's now here from Genesis. And it's a very, very nice scripture there in that page. Genesis 33, verses 13 and 14. He said, now urged to take a rapid and difficult journey. He said, the children are tender. The flocks and herds with young are with me. If men should overdrive them one day, all the flocks will die. I will lead on softly, according as the cattle that goeth before me, and the children be able to endure. I'll lead on softly. He said, the children are tender. Don't push them. He considered their incapabilities. He's a very perceptive man. He goes on in the very next paragraph, in life's toilsome way, let the husband and father lead on softly, as the companion of his journey is able to endure. Amidst the world's eager rush for wealth and power, let him learn to stay his steps to comfort and support the one who is called to work by his side. You'd be amazed at how many of us are slave drivers and how much our spouses bite their tongues and say nothing. I have a very fine friend, a professional person, who loved to work himself to death. In fact, he just reveled in it. He ended up in the hospital with ulcers several times, but he just loved to do it. And his wife had nervous problems after nervous problems after nervous problems. And I'm sure he thought, you know, that if she'd only think straight, everything would be fine. But she didn't realize that this person had to do all the work at home and tag along with her husband, in addition, and take care of all the other things that he had never done and knew nothing about, and most of us know nothing about that except the ladies. And he was driving her, and she couldn't keep up. It took him years and years and years before some doctor with hobnail boots and clawed nails and iron teeth told him what an idiot he was. And he had to tell him so firmly, you know, because it was so difficult to get inside of his head. He was made of marble or something. And yet he had to use a diamond-tip drill to get in there. Otherwise, it just bounced off or dulled the bit. He'd been told by many friends the best he had in this world, but he never heard. If he heard, it went right on through. It never lodged, therefore he never changed. Not even his health changed him. But that blessed doctor was able to convince him, you know, that he was a worse dictator than any we've ever seen. That he's destroying himself and his wife. And somehow that man discovered it was truth. He vacillates even now. This has been quite a few years ago. But at least he understands and tries. Most of us are as unconscious as was he about our driving tactics and how we literally crush people with the pace we try to keep. And we're not getting to heaven that way, friends. We're trying to satisfy our egos. Isn't that right? All this bigness and all this rush is just trying to inflate our heads. That's all it's trying to do, really. When you get it all accomplished and look back on it, you say, why was I such a fool? Why did I run through life and never see what was on the sides, you know, what it was all about? Why did I do all of that way? And let me tell you, you lament in sackcloth and ashes many, many times. I had to bury the wife of a man who rushed through life like that. Always gone from his family, overseas, this man. Not an Adventist missionary or anything like that at all. But he kept telling his wife, and they had no children, maybe that was fortunate, someday when I retire, we'll settle down and be together. So he was retired from the military. But he went to work for the state. He's a very young man, out of the military. Went to work for the state, and he finally retired from the state. They bought a beautiful retirement home, just the place they wanted to live, in a retirement community. They hadn't lived there 6 months, and she was ill. A very pleasant woman that he longed to live with, but never had lived with before. He was too busy, too engrossed in his careers. In 6 or 8 months, she was dead. Another member of the church and I had the privilege of going to the hospital and telling him his wife was dead, for he was hospitalized too. And this man, I dare say today, can never forget her because he never lived with her. But he always wanted to. But he never found the time to live with her until she was dead. He's not the only one like that. He really isn't. We all have trouble learning very rapidly about what we're missing, don't we? We're so busy about so many things that the things that really count, we can hardly see as we rush through life. Everything in life has to be like a jet plane. If it isn't, we're impatient and think we're wasting our time. And we are wasting our time rushing and not living. And you can do this with very worthwhile things, making a living for your family, a career, a better job, a profession, education, rushing for recreation, hundreds of things we can rush around doing. But we're really not living, are we? Just speeding through life, not understanding what it's all about. And so overwork, she said, be very careful about overworking, especially the mother, and cautions the fathers to be a blessing to their wives. The last one is one I'm sure we would put down pretty low. We like the last one, but we don't think it's very important. And it's simply called cheerfulness. And I'm sure there's hardly a doctor in the world that prescribes cheerfulness. Maybe they'd like to, but perhaps they'd be branded as not a physician if they talked about cheerfulness. Probably lose their credentials or something, their license to practice. Why don't you give me some medication? That's what you're paid to do. I'm paying you high fees. Talk about cheerfulness. My children can tell me that, or my mother or something. I don't have to pay them, you know. So perhaps that's why you don't prescribe this. It seems so simple. The mother should cultivate a cheerful, contented, happy disposition. Cultivate it. It doesn't come automatically. Every effort in this direction will be abundantly repaid in both the physical well-being and the moral character of her children. Both physical and moral. Be abundantly well paid. Notice that? A cheerful spirit will promote the happiness of her family and in a very great degree improve her own health. A merry heart doeth good like what? So few of us have ever really learned that. We know it's true, don't we? But why practice it? It's too simple. Isn't that right? Tell us something complicated, we'll try hard. Something simple, it's like the sunshine, you know. Why pay any attention to it? But it goes on and says that husbands have a part in this. Let the husband aid his wife by his sympathy and unfailing affection if he wishes to keep her fresh and gladsome. That has something to do with not getting old, by the way. Fresh and gladsome. If he wants her that way, so that she'll be a sunshine in the home, let him help her bear her burdens. His kindness and loving courtesy will be to her a precious encouragement, and the happiness he imparts will bring joy and peace to his own heart, not just hers. The husband and father who is morose, selfish and overbearing, he is not only unhappy himself, but he casts gloom upon all the inmates of his home. They all suffer. He'll reap the result in seeing his wife dispirited and sickly, and his children marred with his own unlovely temper. Just think, that simple little thing, you know, that we can do so easily, but we must cultivate it. It doesn't come automatically, you know. You can't wait for someone else to make you happy, can you? No, we must get on our knees that morning and find out a reason to be happy from God. Isn't that right? Our own hearts are inspired with joy because the Lord is so good to us. And go forth and shed those bright beams of sunshine to everybody we meet that day, but especially our own families. And it'll come back to us reaping abundantly in the fruit we see that day and that the rest of the weeks in our family. We must continue to do this and be blessed. If the mother is deprived of the care and comforts, now she's summarizing. The mother is deprived of the care and comfort she should have. If she is allowed to exhaust her strength through overwork or through anxiety and gloom, the lack of that cheerfulness, her children will be robbed of the vital force and of the mental elasticity and cheerful buoyancy they should inherit. And notice the areas? If the mother doesn't take care of that temperance and self-control, overwork and cheerfulness, the children will be robbed of the vital force, that means our bodies, our physical forces, of the mental elasticity, teachability, in other words, things like that, you see, in ability to learn, understand, and cheerful buoyancy they should inherit. Far better will it be to make the mother's life bright and cheerful, to shield her from want, wearing labor, and depressing care, and let the children inherit good constitutions so they may battle their way through life with their own energetic strength. You see? God will endow them with that through you. We find our children dull of learning. It's probably because of the anxiety of the mother. And maybe she's anxious because of dad. You see? Or overwork. Or intemperate, can all produce dull kids. Then we're embarrassed because our children are not as bright as we are. But who is the most ignorant? We in passing on, you see, from an overworked mother, an intemperate mother, or an unhappy mother, a disposition like that, or a physical body like that. We're the ones that caused it. We blame that, them. Probably the heart of the whole chapter is the next little paragraph. And you've heard it like this before, but here she explains why this is really true. Page 375. Great is the honor and the responsibility placed upon fathers and mothers in that they are to stand in the place of God to their children. That's great honor to stand in the place of God to your children. You know why it talks about that in many places. Their character, I mean the children, their daily life, their methods of training will interpret his words to the little ones. The parents' daily life, I should say. The parents' character, daily lives, methods of training, will interpret God's words to the little ones. In other words, we are translators for Him, right? We're teaching the children what God is saying by our lives and our character. Their influence will win or repel the child's confidence in the Lord's assurances. So it isn't just what I say in worship that day or how I pray, you see. My character, my daily life, my methods of training will translate God's words to them. She goes on and explains this even more in the next paragraph. Happy are the parents whose lives are a true reflection of the divine, so that the promises and commands of God awaken in the child gratitude and reverence. See, the kind of parents who reflect Him. So when the children comes back, gratitude and reverence. The parents whose tenderness and justice and long-suffering interpret to the child the love and justice and long-suffering of God. They see God in us as parents. And who by teaching the child to love and trust and obey them, are teaching him to love and trust and obey his Father in heaven. Parents who impart to a child such a gift have endowed him with a treasure more precious than the wealth of all the ages, a treasure as enduring as eternity. You cannot give him anything more precious. You can work your head off and slave to the bone for a PhD, but that's peanuts. That's pennies. That's almost nothing. You can do many helpful things to give them wealth and a beautiful job and beautiful home and clothing and everything they need, but that's almost nothing. All that will pass away. But to give them, the child, such a gift, a character like God's, is the most precious treasure, more precious than the wealth of all the ages. Put all the money together of all the ages. It isn't worth that much. And it'll always endure. It'll go on and on and on. And the Lord promises to help in this. The last part down at the bottom of the page, in the top of page 377, is the nicest part. And it puts this in true perspective. The mother's work often seems to her an unimportant service. Not too important. It is a work that is rarely appreciated. Others know little of her many cares and burdens. They don't understand. Her days are occupied with a round of little duties, all calling for patient effort, for self-control, for tact, wisdom, self-sacrificing love. Yet she cannot boast of what she has done as any great achievement. Can't boast about it at all. And we say, what are you bragging about, you know? That's drudgery. Can't boast about it at all. She's only kept things in the home running smoothly. That's all, you see. Often weary and perplexed, she has tried to speak kindly to the children, to keep them busy and happy, and to guide their little feet in the right path. She feels that she has accomplished nothing. But it is not so. She describes to perfection, doesn't she? How most mothers have felt. But it is not so. Heavenly angels watch the careworn mother, noting the burdens she carries day by day. Her name may not have been heard in the world, but it is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Does it make a difference? The world might not care, but it's written down there. And close with this marvelous little sentence here. There is a God above, and the light and glory from His throne rests upon the faithful mother as she tries to educate her children to resist the influence of evil. His light and glory rests upon that mother as she attempts to do the work. No other work can equal hers in importance. She is not like the artist to paint a form of beauty upon canvas, nor like the sculptor to chisel it from marble. She is not like the author to embody a noble thought in words of power, nor like the musician to express a beautiful sentiment in melody. It is hers with the help of God to develop in the human soul the likeness of the divine. There is a difference. How little human beings have seen the value that God has placed upon motherhood. Far above the work of ministers, for every minister had to have a mother. Right? Far above the work of any missionaries or any evangelists, any apostles, any disciples, any leaders, far above them is the craftsmanship, the artistry that's required of a mother. For 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all their young lives, the mother is on the job, carrying out her trade, if I may call it that, and with the skill far beyond any artist. She's not chiseling on marble or dabbing on a canvas or putting words in print or on some strings of a piano or a violin. She's putting in living strings, a living, walking, breathing picture, not an immovable image. A person who in the very image of Christ, the image of God, and she's reproducing the likeness of God in that human being until even the Lord Himself will say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." The greatest judge of all the artists of all ages will say to her, "This is the kind of work I wanted." And that precious soul will live millions and millions and millions of years ever praising the Heavenly Father from all blessings flow. Is it nice to work with the greatest creator, the only creator? The creator of human beings such as we are and these precious little children. Friends, let's restore our values where they really belong. Let's honor mothers more than on Mother's Day and put them at the top of the pile. The greatest prestige, the queen of the home, is the work of that greatest of all arts, being a mother and also a father. Let us stand for prayer. Loving Father in heaven, forgive us for our neglect and misunderstanding, for our ignorance. When life gets routine and day by day we have to do the same things, we so quickly forget in our dullness, our lack of good judgment and perception, that our work is the greatest ever committed to men. That working with human souls is such a delicate, such a refined work, that only by the skills that God Himself will give us can we possibly do a good work for these children. Somehow teach us to put first things first. The salvation of souls, the love for human beings, is so very, very important. And throughout the ceaseless ages of eternity, these souls will live and be a praise to God and show forth the craftsmanship of godly parents, especially mothers. Lord, be with us in our homes. Forgive us for our failures and neglect. Enable us to redeem the time. And especially bless those who have children now or contemplating families. Lord, be with them. May they make those decisions most carefully. May we take much, much time to do this most important work of all works, the training of our children. And may we work with God, the mighty Creator, that these little ones might be just like Jesus. We pray in His wonderful name. Amen.